Okay, so I'm going to talk about a new technique for evading censorship firewalls that piggybacks on top of user-generated content. I'll discuss how this technique can be more robust against attempts to block communication, provides protection against attempts to identify users of the system, and requires fewer resources to deploy than existing anti-censorship systems available. This is work I've done at Georgia Tech with Nick Feimster and Santosh Vimpala. So I'm first going to try to convince you that internet censorship is a problem that you should care about. The organization Reporters Without Borders has released a list of 23 countries that it knows either censor or heavily monitor their internet access. People living in these areas comprise 1.7 billion people, or a full 25% of the world's population. And included on this list, along with some more famous countries such as Iran and China, which we all think of when we think of internet censorship, are more democratic countries such as Australia and South Korea. So, and I emphasize this point that internet censorship is a problem that people should care about even in supposedly free or democratic societies. For example, this is a news article that I have about Australia's pending censorship legislation, which is rumored will ban topics such as graffiti and euthanasia. And here's an article about the US government's recent takedown of a blog hosting service because some of the content it hosted was objectionable. And you can actually find articles about a bunch of different countries, the UK, Germany, France, and so on. And so I believe that this is a problem that really everyone using the internet, almost everyone using the internet, really should care about at this point. So, at this point, I'm going to now take you through a brief primer on what internet censorship is and how it works, and explain some of the existing techniques taken to solve it. So the basic setup is you have Alice, and she wants to obtain some content from Bob. Now, if Alice accesses the internet from behind a censorship firewall, then the censor may monitor her communication, may block this communication, and may even punish Alice for even attempting to communicate with Bob, even if she was not successful in doing so. So the solution to this problem, to these two problems really, is to use a helper. So I'm going to call this a helper. And it's just an entity that's going to forward traffic between Alice and Bob so that they don't have to directly communicate with each other. And you probably can think of some examples of how these things might work already, but I'm going to go through some forms of helpers you can use. But before I do so, I'm going to go through some design goals for these helpers. First, we might want that they be robust against attempts to block their communication, that the sensor will not be able to block communication between Alice, Bob, and this helper. We might also want it to be deniable against attempts to identify users of the helper, so you can't actually tell who's communicating with the helper. And finally, we might also like that it doesn't require much infrastructure to actually deploy these helpers into the real world so that they can more readily be adopted. So the first type of helper that I'm going to discuss is a network of proxy servers. And you can probably think of many examples of systems that you know. The most famous example is Tor. And the way these work is that you have this network of proxy servers, and it's going to forward traffic, usually using a bunch of encryption along the way, between Bob and Alice through several hops of this network. And so these systems, they're pretty popular, and they actually work very well in practice, and a lot of people use them. But there are a few things about them which we may want to improve upon. The first is that if the list of proxy servers itself is public, then they may easily be blocked. And in fact, we've seen that China has done this, for example, with the list of Tor's proxy, public proxy servers. Second, if the use of encryption itself is incriminating in any way, then these systems are not usable because they make no attempt to obfuscate their encrypted traffic. And finally, they require, most of all, a lot of dedicated infrastructure to operate. You need a lot of hardware and network resources to have this network of proxy servers. So now another form of system you can consider is to build a covert channel. An example of this type of system is Infranet. And the way this is going to work is you're going to have a third-party host, say Usenix.org, okay, and it's going to hide information from Bob inside of its web traffic. So if Alice uses Infranet, then she's going to look like, it's going to look like she's just browsing Usenix.org, but in fact, she's also receiving content from Bob inside of her web traffic. Okay? This system is nice because it's much more difficult for the sensor to differentiate between legitimate users of Usenix.org and people that are simply browsing this website just to get a hold of content from you know, somebody like Bob. However, they face some deployment issues, and they require a lot of dedicated infrastructure to operate. You need to have these web servers, custom web server software installed. And additionally, they may be easy to block if unless you use them with a lot of more popular websites. So our solution to this problem, the internet censorship problem, is called Collage. And it is going to it uses user-generated content to help defeat censorship. It's robust against attempts to block communication between parties. It protects the identities of its users and requires no dedicated infrastructure to operate. So how does Collage actually work? What we do is we assume that Bob is a Flickr user, a user of Flickr, the popular photo sharing website you've probably heard of, and that he has a fresh batch of photographs that he wants to upload to Flickr. And what he's going to do is before he uploads his photo to Flickr, he's going to hide his message or embed his message inside of his Flickr photos. He's then going to upload them to Flickr, and Alice will later download these photos. So the nice thing about this this design is that, first of all, Alice and Bob both generate pretty innocuous-looking traffic. Alice is just downloading photos from Flickr, and Bob is just uploading photos to his Flickr photo album just as he normally would. And second of all, it requires no dedicated infrastructure to operate. You're just putting your content on Flickr, which already serves millions and millions of photos every single day. And I'll also discuss later in the talk how Collage achieves robustness by using redundancy. I also point out that although I've used Flickr in this example, you could potentially use other websites, YouTube, blog sites, so on and so forth. So you may be skeptical that Collage can actually work in practice, but we have a few reasons to believe that it can. First of all, there's a lot of user-generated content available to serve its purpose. Flickr, for example, has in excess of 4 billion images hosted, and YouTube actually receives an entire day's worth of video uploads every single minute. Second, there are a lot of user-generated content hosts available. It's not just sites like YouTube and Flickr. You also have a lot of forum sites. You have a lot of blog sites. And so together, this vast amount of user-generated content and the vast number of user-generated content hosts could all potentially be used to store this censored data that could serve a dual purpose. Finally, we have tools available to us that can store the censored data inside of our user-generated content. These tools are steganography and watermarking, and I'll discuss those a little bit later in the talk. So at this point, hopefully I've convinced you that internet censorship is an interesting problem that you should care about, and that we have a new idea that we believe can help solve it. At this point, I'm going to go into how Collage works in detail, and afterwards I'll show you a quick performance evaluation and give you a demo of a Collage application that we've written. So I'm now going to go through how Collage works step by step pretty quickly, and then I'll go into details on several of these steps. So again, we have Alice, and she wants to obtain some content from Bob. So the first thing Bob needs to do is actually figure out what that content, what that message is that he wants to send. He could either write it himself, he could get it from a third party, doesn't particularly matter. Next, Bob is going to pick a message identifier. And I'm going to go into what exactly this message identifier is later in the talk. But the basic idea is that it is shared between Alice and Bob, and it is used to agree exactly where Alice will find Bob's messages on the user-generated content hosts. After this, Bob is going to obtain a set of user-generated cover media, for example, photos from his digital camera. For the rest of the talk, I'm going to refer to any user-generated cover media as vectors, as this conveys the fact that they can actually store censored data inside of them. After Bob has his vectors, he's then going to embed his message inside of his vectors, and I'll discuss this on the next slide. He's then going to upload these vectors to a user-generated content host, as I said before, and Alice will download them. And this, we have a pretty sophisticated procedure for achieving this, which I'll also talk about in about 5 minutes. And then once Alice has the user-generated content, the vectors that Bob hid his message inside of, she's then going to extract the message. So I'm first going to go through now exactly how Bob is going to store his message inside of his vectors. There's a three-step process for doing this. You first encrypt the message using the message identifier as a private key. And this is going to ensure that no one else besides Alice and Bob can read the message, because it is assumed that they are the only ones who know this message identifier. Next, we're going to run the encrypted message through a rateless erasure coder. And what this is going to do is it's going to generate a series of chunks of the original message, such that Alice will only need to obtain some small subset of those chunks, and she can still regain the original message. So, for example, Bob may generate 1,000 chunks, but Alice will only need to obtain any 50-size subset of those chunks. After you do this, you then embed these chunks inside of your cover vectors, and the goal of this step is simply to store the message chunks inside the vectors. And there are two techniques you can do this. So it's to store the chunks inside the vectors without disrupting their appearance. This is obviously important. You don't want to disturb the actual appearance. So to achieve this, you can use two potential algorithms. One is steganography, which you may have heard of. The goal of this is to conceal the actual existence of the message. And the other is watermarking, which simply seeks to make it difficult to remove the chunks from the vectors without destroying the cover vector. And so I emphasize here that we're simply using these two techniques to store sensor data inside of our vectors. In step 7, after Alice has received Bob's vectors, she is then going to do the reverse of this procedure to recover the message from those vectors. Now, I point out a nice feature of this embedding scheme that we have here, and that is that because we use the erasure coding, this ensures some redundancy in the message itself. The message will be spread across many vectors, and the receiver can simply retrieve some subset of those vectors. And so this ensures some level of redundancy. Okay, so we're going back to Bob now. After he embeds his message into his vectors, he then is going to upload them to user-generated content host. And the job is, the difficult part now is that Alice actually needs to find the vectors that Bob uploaded to user-generated content host. So without any sort of guidance, this is like really, really difficult, because Alice may actually need to crawl, for example, all of Flickr, download all of Flickr's photos in the process of trying to find Bob. So like this is obviously completely unworkable, right? So what we've done is we've developed an algorithm that will allow Alice and Bob to agree on a very small subset of a user-generated content host. And this will cut down the amount of crawling that Alice actually needs to do. The algorithm we've developed to do this is called task mapping. And it's going to produce a list of actions, or we call them tasks, that can be performed on a user-generated content host to yield a set of vectors. So an example of a task might yield a set of photos on Flickr by performing, for example, a keyword search. Okay, so the way task mapping is going to work is you take the message identifier that we assume that Alice and Bob agreed upon before, and you hash it. So in this case, if the message identifier is nytimes.com, it might hash down to 1. You assume that Alice and Bob each have a list of tasks, and I'll discuss how they come to have this list of tasks later on, but you assume that they have a list of tasks, and you also hash these. You hash them to the same space so that you can then deterministically map the message identifier to a set of these tasks. And for those of you who are sort of recognizing this, this is actually just a consistent hashing scheme. So in this example, for example, we have the identifier is going to map to tasks 9 and 11 here. These tasks represent actions that Alice can perform on a user-generated content host to get a set of vectors. So an example of a task may be that Alice will search for blue flowers on Flickr. Now, obviously, if Alice is going to be searching for pictures of blue flowers, for example, Bob then needs to upload pictures of blue flowers so that Alice can find them. So this task mapping serves a purpose for both Alice and Bob. So to recap, if Alice and Bob want to send a message to each other using Collage, Bob is first going to pick a message identifier. He's going to embed his message inside of his user-generated content vectors. He'll then perform task mapping himself to discover where and how he should upload these vectors to a user-generated content host. Afterwards, Alice will perform task mapping herself to discover where she can find those vectors, and then she'll download the vectors and decode the message. So that, in a nutshell, is how collage works. We now want to take a step back and ask, does collage meet the design goals that I proposed at the beginning of the talk? First, because collage uses erasure coding and a variety of user-generated content hosts, this provides a level of robustness, because even if the sensor blocks some vectors and some content hosts, receivers of these messages will still be able to recover the message by fetching the remaining vectors from the remaining content hosts. Second, collage is deniable against attempts to identify its users, at least at a first high level, because users generate traffic to and from these user-generated content hosts. However, as you can imagine, the exact deniability of any particular use of collage depends greatly upon the types of tasks that you choose, the types of application that you're using, and the frequency with which you perform these tasks. So we provide a toolbox that allows you to build deniable applications, but it's pretty much impossible for us to actually make them deniable for you. Finally, collage requires no dedicated infrastructure to operate, clearly because all of our messages are stored on user-generated content hosts that already store lots of user-generated content. So you may be wondering now that we have this nice scheme for exchanging messages using user-generated content, how do you actually begin using collage? Now, obviously the first thing, if you want to use it to exchange messages, as you know you might want to do, you obviously need to first obtain the software itself. And you clearly have to do this without using collage. You know, every anti-censorship system seems to face this bootstrapping problem. You can't use collage without having collage. So you have to get it from somewhere else. Some secure channel will work. You can get it from a CD-ROM. You know, you could have people spam this software to people, to their inbox. You could just bring your computer to some secure network. Doesn't really matter, as long as it's a secure channel. Next, after you have the collage software and all of its associated tasks and such, you may actually need to update the list of tasks that you use when you're using collage. And this is because user-generated content hosts are dynamic in nature, right? So Flickr, for example, may add and remove features as time goes on, and you'll need to, therefore, add and remove the tasks that you use to find the vectors stored on that content host. You can do this using multiple mechanisms. Two I gave here are you can either receive these updates using collage itself. You could even derive these from some online resource, like you could have a page that has a list of popular keywords and you then derive your tasks from those. And then finally, as I mentioned, Bob and Alice need to agree on this message identifier for the messages that they communicate with each other. And I describe this part a lot more in the paper. There's a lot of examples, but I'll just mention here that it's highly application-specific, and two of the types of ways you could do this, for example, are you could derive the message identifier from, say, the date, or you could do some sort of rotation scheme, the key thing being that that Alice and Bob do not necessarily need to communicate in order to agree on these message identifiers. So that's how you would begin using collage if you actually wanted to send and receive messages. If you don't live anywhere where you need to send and receive messages using collage, you can still help the project by donating your vectors. This is where the using humans part comes in. You can donate your vectors, you can donate your photos, you can donate your tweets, so on and so forth, to store censored content inside of them. And finally, you can also help by writing collage applications. So now that I've described how collage works, I'm now going to give you a quick performance evaluation and show you a demo of a collage application that we've written. So we care about three performance metrics with collage. We care about the amount of time that it takes to send and receive messages. We care about the traffic overhead required to do that. And we also care about the amount of storage required on the user-generated content hosts. Now, as you can imagine, these metrics actually vary quite a lot between the types of tasks you use, the types of applications you use. So I can't give you like solid numbers for any in general for this. So instead, I'm going to show you the performance metrics for two example applications that we've written using collage. So the two applications we've written, the first one publishes news articles from the BBC inside of photos that are hosted on Flickr. So to publish one 30-kilobyte news article, you need about 5 medium-sized Flickr images and about 7 megabytes of traffic over seven minutes. So you'll notice that this overhead is like really, really high. The reason for this is that in the process of uploading and downloading photos, you need to actually download a lot of thumbnails from Flickr's website, you need to download a lot of advertisements. And so that's why this traffic level is so high. The second application publishes, posts covert tweets inside of regular tweets on Twitter. So to publish one 140-byte covert tweet, you need about 30 regular tweets, and you use about 2 megabytes of traffic in this case. And we spread the posting of these 30 tweets over the span of an hour because this more closely approximates how people actually use Twitter, even though that's still a lot of tweets to post in 1 hour. So the takeaway message from this case study here is that even though Collage is a very low performance channel, as you can see, it's still useful in a lot of situations. It's not unreasonable for somebody to need to wait 5 minutes to retrieve their daily news if that's the only way that they can actually retrieve the news. So at this point, I'm now going to show you a demo of the first application, which fetches news articles off of Flickr. So, yes. So this is the application, and what it's going to do is we're going to go fetch the news, and to do that, we're going to open an instance of Firefox. Now, you don't need to actually pay attention to what's happening in this Firefox window because it goes by quite quickly, as you can tell, but what it's doing is it's browsing Flickr, and it's downloading photos, and it's doing this all automatically. The user just sits here and waits, and it's downloading these photos, and each photo it downloads, it's going to try to extract censored content from it. If it does happen to find some censored content, some censored chunks, it's going to try to pass those to the erasure coder, and once it's done, it'll display the news as you can see there. So, you know, this is an example usage. It doesn't take too long to actually get your news using Collage. So that's the demo. We will be putting this demo on our website. I wanted to have it available like right now, but unfortunately, it'll be available very soon for you to go try out. And additionally, if you have an account, a Flickr Pro account, you can actually donate your photos. We're going to be putting a service online that will allow you to donate your photos to store these news articles. So this is, again, the using people part. So the next time you want to upload photos to your Flickr photo album, I encourage you to visit our website, and you can actually use our tool that we've made available to upload your photos. So in conclusion, I presented Collage, which is a new technique for evading internet censorship that tunnels messages inside of user-generated content. Discussed how Collage is robust against attempts to block the communication, protects the identities of its users, and requires no dedicated infrastructure to do so. There's a lot of room for future work in this area. For example, although we know it's possible to construct deniable applications, as I mentioned before, it remains to be seen exactly how you would do so in a general case. We're also looking at how you can learn from users' behavior in order to improve Collage's deniability properties. For example, by looking at users' timing behavior and using those, mimicking those. And finally, we're also looking at if you can build a Tor bridge node discovery service using Collage to help people who use Tor. So at this point, I refer you to our website for further information, and thank you for listening.
Hi. I really liked the work, by the way, and I thought you gave a great talk. I was just curious about one point. If I want to donate my photos, for example, is there any way for that to be tracked? I mean, could I ever get in trouble, for example, with that? Saying that my photos are now trafficking censored data.
So, we've been making the assumption when we've been building this Flickr donation service, for example, that you, the person donating the photos, is not inside of a censored region. So, you're not actually going to get a visit from the police, hopefully, if that's your question. But also, if you're asking whether somebody could actually tell whether your photos contained censored content, it all depends upon the information hiding scheme that you used to put the data into the photos. So if the sensor can actually, or if somebody can detect that this content is hidden inside of your photos, then yes, they could identify your photos and they maybe could block them or take them down or something like that. So, but that's completely dependent upon the type of information hiding scheme that you use.
Hi, Paul Van Oorschot, Carleton University. Thanks for the talk, it was really good. We always like to think ahead a couple steps. So in the countries where or regions where people are going to be punished for trying to avoid this. Can we do anything to somehow hide the software? Like if I show up at your doorstep and I go to your computer and I look for this collage program. So I guess that's one thing.
I mean, we haven't considered that. That's right. Kind of tangential, but that sort of is the flip side to the fact that we require no dedicated infrastructure in the network to do this, right. Is that you then, therefore, you need a lot of software on your own computer. And I mean, that's a very interesting thing to consider, but yeah, we just haven't really
looked
at that.
So the second part is, in your demo, when you're interacting with Flickr, the number of transfers, of course, because it was automated, is much quicker. So
yes.
A network detection program interacting with Flickr could certainly detect that.
That's of course possible. So obviously, I wanted to make the demo as short as possible to fit within the presentation. There are many techniques you can use to increase the deniability of the traffic that Collage generates. Right. And for example, we already have an option that will allow you to turn on think times for each request, you know, to inject spacing. That's one thing you can do to, you know, improve the traffic mix that you see. And you can also do things like just introducing random variations. You know, instead of always clicking on, you know, photos in order, you could occasionally click on something else. You could stop visiting this website, go to another website. You know, there are a lot of things you could do to improve the deniability. And yes, so for the demo, I just wanted to fit it within 30 seconds.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about the tasks and the importance of maybe keeping them synchronized or rotating them? I could imagine a scenario with where you're in one of these countries that are doing censorship. You know, they might do other things like monitor network traffic.
Sure.
And if they see that Bob is always uploading blue flowers, and then there are other requests always searching for blue flowers, I can imagine how that'd be problematic.
Yeah. So I guess there were sort of two parts in there. The first is about the tasks themselves. So the idea is that you don't map each message identifier to just one task. You map it to a large set. And the idea would be that, first of all, you hopefully wouldn't use that particular set of tasks more than a few times. And that because you'd have multiple, if you have multiple users, for example, using the same message identifier, they would pick different subset, different, you know, randomly. They'd pick them randomly and they'd get different tasks to execute. As for actually agreeing on the tasks themselves, that's sort of a strength of the consistent hashing scheme we use, is that it allows there to be quite a fair bit of disagreement between different users' task databases, and they're still able to reach some consensus on how to exchange the messages. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Hi, I'm Billy from University of Michigan. As a responsible researcher, have you thought about what if this tool is used by terrorists to communicate?
And people have asked us this before. Yeah, you know, could the terrorist use this? And yes, of course the terrorist could use this. It's just a tool. We don't really dictate who's going to be using it. I think the standard answer to this sort of question is just to say that I think, you know, the terrorists, they don't have any sort of laws governing them. They probably will have an even better communication mechanism than this already available to them. So.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.